From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Another busy day of confirmation hearings on Capitol Hill today, so let's give a listen. President-elect Donald Trump's nominee to lead the Central Intelligence Agency, Republican Congressman Mike Pompeo of Kansas, is testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee as the CIA and allegations of Russian hacking and incoming President Donald Trump's skepticism about those allegations are front and center. Also on the table, the use of enhanced interrogation tactics or torture, which Trump has said work. Here's Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein questioning Pompeo.
I want to ask one follow-up question to what the chairman asked, and that's dealing with those enhanced interrogation techniques. And that is that if you were ordered by the president to restart the CIA's use of enhanced interrogation techniques that fall outside of the Army Field Manual, would you comply?
Senator, absolutely not. Moreover, I can't imagine that I would be asked that by the president-elect or then-president. But I'm very clear. I voted for the change that put the Army Field Manual in place as a member of Congress. I understand that law very, very quickly and am also deeply aware that any changes to that will come through Congress and the president.
And regular order.
And regular order, yes, ma'am, yes. Absolutely. With respect to the outlines of what's in the Army Field Manual, there's no doubt in my mind about the limitations it places not only on the DOD but on the Central Intelligence Agency, and I'll always comply with the law.
Another question. How will you handle the president-elect's refutation of the intelligence community's high assessments that Russian intelligence units, namely the GRU and the FSB, did, in fact, hack and spearfish into the campaigns and parties of both political parties this past campaign season?
Senator, as with, I think I answered Senator Warner the same way, my obligation as the director of the CIA is to tell every policymaker the facts as best the intelligence agency has developed them. With respect to this report in particular, it's pretty clear about what took place here, about Russian involvement in efforts to hack information and to have an impact on American democracy. I'm very clear-eyed about what that intelligence report says, and I have every expectation as we continue to develop the facts, I will relay those not only to the president but the team around him and to you all so that we all can have a robust discussion about how to take on what is an enormous threat from cyber. I think you all know that. You all have lived it. This is very real. It is growing. It is not new in that sense. But this was an aggressive action taken by the senior leadership inside of Russia, and America has an obligation, and the CIA has a part of that obligation to protect that information.
Well, Congressman Pompeo was also pushed on the mass collection of metadata. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon brought up an op-ed Pompeo co-authored last year.
You said, let's get back into the business of collecting all of this metadata, and I'm curious what kind of information about finances and lifestyles would you not enter into your idea of this giant database?
Well, Senator, first of all, I have to begin by saying today that would be, in most instances, what you referred to there would be unlawful under current law. And so as the director of the CIA, you have my assurance we will not engage in unlawful activity. But I think this committee, the American people, demand that if there's publicly available information someone has out there on our public available site, I think we have an obligation to use that information to keep Americans safe. If someone's out there on their Facebook page talking about an attack or plotting an attack against America, I think you would find the director of the CIA and the intelligence community grossly negligent if they didn't pursue that information.
Congressman, I don't take a backseat to anybody in terms of protecting this country when our security is on the line. I wrote the section of the Freedom Act that gives the government emergency authority to move when it's critical to protect the country. That's not what we're talking about here.
That's one of the exchanges today. Also being questioned today, retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson, tapped by Donald Trump to lead the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and retired Marine Corps General James Mattis, Trump's pick for Secretary of Defense. We will monitor it all.
Senate Republicans are one step closer to repealing Obamacare. Early this morning, they voted 51-48 to approve a budget blueprint that would let them repeal major parts of the law, something that is expected to take weeks at least. But Republicans don't have a plan yet to replace the Affordable Care Act, and hospitals across the country are worried about that. Joining us now is A.J. Wilhelmy, the president and CEO of the Illinois Health and Hospital Association. He's in Washington, D.C. to attend the American Hospital Association's meeting on the future of the Affordable Care Act. AJ, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And do you have any insight on what the future of the Affordable Care Act is at this point? What's going to happen?
I think there's a great deal of uncertainty at this stage in how the Congress will move forward. There's certainly a great deal of talk about reconciliation to advance the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And of course, the hospital community feels there should be no repeal of the ACA without an adequate and simultaneous replacement to assure coverage and access to health care for over 20 million Americans, including 1 million in the state of Illinois.
And is it your expectation that that's what Congress will do, that they'll have a replacement right away when they decide to repeal the Affordable Care Act? It does sound like, especially in the Senate, a few more Republican senators are leaning in that direction. They don't want to repeal without an immediate replacement.
We're hearing that as well, especially in the Senate. As you said, that would be, in our opinion, the appropriate move with respect to the ACA. No repeal until there is that adequate and simultaneous replacement.
What is at stake for hospitals here?
There's a great deal at stake for hospitals, for the patients and communities we serve, and for the state's economy. And so for hospitals, many would be in dire financial straits if the ACA was repealed. You know, right now, about 40% of our hospitals are operating in the red or on a very thin margin, and they would face difficult decisions, including laying off staff, reducing or eliminating services, or putting very important infrastructure projects on hold, none of which would be good for the patients and communities they serve. And with respect to the state's economy, we have preliminary estimates that show the impact to the state would be between $11 and $13 billion in lost economic activity. That translates to about 84,000 to 95,000 jobs. So there's a great deal at stake for the state of Illinois, its economy, the hospital community that's striving to fulfill their mission of caring for their patients and communities, and most importantly, for the people of the state of Illinois who rely on coverage through the Affordable Care Act.
I imagine, though, that people who are in favor of the repeal of Obamacare would say, well, you got along fine before the Affordable Care Act. Why would things be so bad if it went away?
So before the Affordable Care Act, we know that the numbers in terms of the levels of uncompensated care and bad debt were much larger. So people, instead of having access to a primary care physician, would present to the emergency department. And we know that that's not the appropriate venue of care for those individuals, and that that's not the most costly venue, or cost-efficient, excuse me, a venue of care. So we want to make sure that we have a system, and this is partly what the ACA has advanced, a system that really looks for how we can transform healthcare, improve healthcare, looking at enhanced care coordination, getting people the right care at the right time in the right place, and also making sure that we improve the quality of healthcare, both of which will lead to better outcomes and lower costs for the healthcare system. Some of that we feel would be lost if the Affordable Care Act were to be repealed without, again, that adequate replacement.
Do you have any ideas about what the replacement, if there is one, would be at this point?
We're all getting a sense of where the Congress might go on this question. And so what we want to impart on our members of Congress from the Illinois delegation is that there should continue to be coverage for those 1 million individuals that rely on that coverage today. And some of the other issues that we know are paramount to the ACA on the prohibition against discriminating on pre-existing conditions, for young adults to have coverage under their parents' health plans, and other key provisions of the ACA. So we look forward to having those conversations with our delegation.
What grade would you give the Affordable Care Act?
We never felt that the Affordable Care Act was a perfect legislation or a perfect law. And we always envisioned working with our delegation on ways to improve the Affordable Care Act. So when we look at some of the challenges, we know that the insurance marketplace There is a challenge with the risk pool. There's a challenge with respect to the premiums paid by those that access health coverage through the insurance marketplace, narrow networks and high deductible plans. So we always envisioned having to work on some components of the ACA, including the insurance marketplace.
So, A.J. Wilhelmy, when do you think you're going to know what's going to happen here?
We feel that more will be revealed in, frankly, the coming days, but certainly the coming weeks. But we want to remain vigilant in getting our message out to our delegation, working very closely with the American Hospital Association and my colleagues from around the country so that we can make sure our elected officials understand what's at stake with this decision about the ACA and that they can understand the impact to hospitals and the patients and communities we serve.
That's A.J. Wilhelmy, who is the president and CEO of the Illinois Health and Hospital Association. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Last night, Jimmy Fallon turned his entire hour over to departing First Lady Michelle Obama, including asking her to write a thank you note.
Thank you, Barack, for proving you're not a lame duck, but my very own silver fox.
Well, earlier in the week, the president tearfully thanked her.
Michelle LaVon Robinson, girl of the South Side. For the past 25 years, you have not only been my wife and mother of my children, you have been my best friend.
The Obamas' departure after 8 years as the most scrutinized African-American couple on the American stage is prompting a lot of memories of Michelle.
You don't stoop to their level. No, our motto is, when they go low, we go high.
Well, Michelle, you're pretty strong. You could totally bat on the Olympics.
Well, thank you, Sarah. I do try to exercise every day.
Really? Because I think exercise is ew.
Exercise is not L.
The disrespect of our ambitions and intellect, the belief that you can do anything you want to a woman, it is cruel. It's frightening. And the truth is, it hurts. It hurts. I had to answer some basic questions for myself. Who am I? No, really, who am I? What do I care about? And the answers to those questions have resulted in the woman who stands before you today.
Got a good opening, this. Good stabs.
This is my song.
This is it.
This is for my girls all around the world. Stand up, hold your head up, don't take nothing from nobody.
Michelle Obama singing car karaoke with James Corden, giving a speech in New Hampshire after Donald Trump's comments about women. You can also probably see her in your mind's eye planting vegetable gardens with kids. A new book is titled, What is the Meaning of Michelle? And 16 writers try to answer that question. Actors Alicia Hall and Jason Moran talk about seeing a powerful marriage work when they're told that black marriages are in trouble. Benilda Little writes about seeing a dark-skinned woman who looks like her and feeling seen by her. Yolanda Galt Cavanis writes about Michelle Obama's realness, how when she was asked on 60 Minutes if she was worried about her husband's safety as president, she said coolly, as a black man, Barack can get shot at the gas station. The Meaning of Michelle was edited by Veronica Chambers, writer, author, and current JSK Knight Fellow at Stanford University. Hi, Veronica.
Hi.
And we're also joined by one of the contributing essayists, Sarah Lewis, a professor of history of art and architecture and African and African-American studies at Harvard University. Sarah, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Veronica, you write you had your newborn strapped to your chest when this fellow named Obama came along. It was Michelle that you also fell in love with.
Absolutely. I mean, it's so meaningful that for my daughter's whole life of memory, she's nine now, her president has been Barack Obama. Her first lady has been Michelle Obama. She literally doesn't remember another family in the White House.
You say your daughter's born with the most amazing role model in the White House, the kind of role model unlike any enjoyed by previous generations of brown-skinned girls. We love Shell. The power of that in these pages, what is the power of that?
She came exactly as she was. And it's a power of authenticity. She not only was able to come with gravitas the way that she did in New Hampshire when she was talking about how important it is for a woman to be respected. At the same time, she's done Mom Dancing with Jimmy Fallon. And so what I've loved as a woman of color, and for my daughter, is the balance. And that's not been something that I think we've had modeled in quite the same way ever.
You write you've had style icons, Dorothy Dandridge, Diana Ross. But here's Michelle Obama. She's not a model, an actress, a musician. She's quite simply the star of her own life.
Yes.
Sarah Lewis, you also write about the image of Michelle Obama.
What I was struck by was really one of the earliest kind of statements First Lady Michelle Obama made about herself. And she repeated it as if a refrain. And it was, "I'm trying to be as authentic as I can be." What does it mean to try to be authentic, right? You don't try to be authentic. But ultimately, what she was hinting at is an understanding that her authenticity in this role was to endure an examination that upended centuries of various associations between race and representation. So for her, authenticity became a revolutionary act, a kind of declarative act.
As you say, she has said, "I will walk anyone through my life," and she did, donating her body to the nation's gaze for constant assessment for us all. Look, many modern-day first ladies go through this idea of, are you too much involved in your husband's affairs, or are you too much retreating to the kitchen? They're always judged, but there's this extra dollop of being the black woman that America would gaze at. And you take us, Professor, all the way back to the Mask of Blackness commissioned by King James at the birth of the New World.
He has his then consort, Queen Anne, and her ladies cover themselves in black paint to perform as princesses from the River Niger. And in this mask, they are cleansed of their blackness. And it was a scandal at the court. I thought of this play when one of her friends said about Michelle Obama, "She's a private person in a public role, a black woman in a costume drama previously only played by whites," right? I thought about how many different centuries of representation she is upending to ultimately reverse the very act of that play, which was meant to signify blackness as something that needed to be cleansed, right?
Right.
So she ultimately becomes a figure of reversal.
Just being black. Veronica, it's not always that heavy. Sometimes,
yes.
Sometimes you have writers who just, love the idea of maybe, she could be their friend.
Yes. Yolanda Galt Cavanis was a great example of that. When she starts her essay, "Please, I've been knowing Michelle LaVon Robinson," when I read it, I kind of stepped back. I was like, can we do this? Can we say this? And I realized that for some people, she's a kind of up-close magic. Even if they've never met her, she feels so familiar, and they talk about her that way.
These are all essays of admiration. But we know she has her detractors, and there have been a flurry of public officials being suspended for tweeting out, just really dispiriting tweets about Michelle Obama's looks, that she looks like an ape. That her body is not attractive. Professor Lewis, how does that fit in for you?
Well, look, one of the main political sort of effects she has in terms of her image is she reverses this association, as I said before, between race and power and beauty. So it doesn't come to me as a surprise that she would endure these attacks. But there is something else that I think is just as insidious, and it's something that April Ryan and Jonathan Capehart were speaking about, and that's to do with invisibility and her own invisibility. Do you know she would take long walks around Washington, D.C., then was often unrecognized? As maybe Frederick Douglass might put it, what thought picture do we have in our minds when we look at a body like Michelle Obama's, tall, beautiful, dignified. Why do we disregard that body? Why could she be unrecognized? You know, this is part of the history that we need to excavate in this country, around the world. And she's helped us do that. This is part of what I meant about her body being donated to the collective for assessment, so that not just that we could assess her, so that we could assess ourselves to understand how we could have gotten to this point where a First Lady would be denigrated in this way. Right?
Well, and Veronica, I'm thinking of Damon Young's essay in which he writes, yeah, she was a woman whose undeniably black features made her stunning. The lean and athletic Michelle was blessed with a curvy behind. He wants to be respectful because she's the First Lady, so he kind of stops there. But yes, she wasn't the kind of beautiful we'd usually seen on the covers of Vogue.
Yes. You were describing earlier those really awful moments that people have attributed to her. I don't think they're seeing her at all. And I think you see a similar backlash with Serena Williams. You saw a similar backlash with the actress from Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. They're not actually looking at that human being at all. And they don't really see their face, their lips, their hair, because they can't. And they don't have any tools with which to do so. So one of the most powerful things that she's done is she's given us the tools, because we've seen her so often. I remember a really early portrait that I saw that was actually French Vogue. She looked like a John Singer Sargent painting. And I'd never seen a black woman dressed like that who wasn't an actress with beautiful brown skin, with her hair and her features. It just took my breath away. We've had this collective experience, and so now so many of us have learned how to see differently.
Well, see others differently, but as Damon Young writes, see yourselves differently. And I'm speaking of African Americans. The defense of Michelle, Damon writes, helped many of us acknowledge, accept, confront, and attempt to alter some of the more unsavory and unflattering latent beliefs and subconscious feelings we possessed about our skin and our noses and our eyes and our hair.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The name of the book is The Meaning of Michelle, 16 Writers on the Iconic First Lady and How Her Journey Inspires Our Own, edited by Veronica Chambers. And one of the featured essayists is Sarah Lewis, professor of history of art and architecture and African and African-American studies at Harvard. Thank you both so much.
Well,
thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a new twist in the debate over whether college athletes should be paid. Set up a league that would allow them to skip college altogether and concentrate on their sport while earning a paycheck. A group with deep ties to the NFL is hoping to launch this new league next year with four teams in Southern California. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com, and he joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So how would this league work, and who would be eligible to play?
Eligible, I think anyone who's, you know, over 18, or maybe, I don't know, maybe they'd allow a 17-year-old in. Maybe four teams. They'd start off pretty humbly, and they just want it to be sustainable, all taking place in Southern California, which is smart for a couple of reasons. Travel costs could sink such a league. Players, $50,000 salary, maybe not enough to live on, but close, especially if they get jobs in the offseason. And the idea is a couple of things. One, to break the cartel of the NCAA, the hold that the NCAA has on players who want to play football professionally. And it's not even necessarily a shot at the NCAA. It also is an acknowledgement that some players aren't good enough to, or smart enough, or have no desire to do college work. And really, why should they be forced to, you know, sit in classes they don't want to take, or go through the fiction of being college students just to get an education that they won't need because if they want to go to the NFL?
Well, would the idea be that this is just a training ground for the NFL, or is the idea to actually make money on the viewership of these games, of this new league?
I think they want to do the second thing to support the first thing. They know that not every one of their players would be able to find a roster spot in the NFL. But if they made it a good enough minor league, it could be sustainable. Perhaps, you know, there's a long history of leagues trying to be sustainable. And I know that this league is being compared to the USFL, the XFL, other failed competitors to the NFL. I don't see it that way. I see it as more of an attempt to have a developmental league, like the NBA has a developmental league, which would help NFL teams if there were affiliated or even non-affiliated, essentially minor leagues, which wouldn't be college football. Because remember, to play in professional football, you have to be 3 years. The rule is 3 years having graduated from high school. This is a kind of paternalistic rule that the NFL has to, they say, help the health of their players. I will have to say that right now the NFL has a pretty sweet deal with college football. They get a free minor league. They don't have to worry about it. And the players are trained up pretty well against the highest level of competition. So the NFL has it pretty good.
All right. Well, and there's some news from the NFL I just want to ask you about while we have you, which is the San Diego Chargers are bolting San Diego for Los Angeles, which means LA is going to have two teams now.
Yes, and they don't even like their one team, the Rams. I should say the Rams have worse ratings for every game they played this year in L.A. than they did for any game they ever played in St. Louis. In fact, the Oakland Raiders get better ratings in L.A. than the Rams. But San Diego just couldn't get a deal done with the government. The Chargers couldn't get a deal done with the San Diego government. And voters, to their credit, rejected a stadium funding bill. Right. So once it was clear that they weren't going to get a new stadium, they flew or they fled to L.A.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Ethics watchdogs are asking whether President-elect Donald Trump can really distance himself from his businesses if his two sons are running them, as he announced this week they will. It was also announced that Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, will become senior advisor to Donald Trump. Kushner will also resign from his family real estate firm, Kushner Companies, but there are still concerns about conflicts of interest. Well, that firm has also raised eyebrows over a practice many companies use, a government program that gives foreigners visas and possibly a path to citizenship in exchange for investing money in the U.S. Let's take a look at what some are calling millionaire visas with Jesse Drucker of The New York Times. Jesse, how do they work?
So investors have to put up $500,000 into a qualifying project. And the theory is that the investment is supposed to target distressed neighborhoods and create jobs and economic development. And in exchange for the investment, the investors get a 2-year visa and hopefully a fast track to citizenship sometime after that, yeah, after the kind of project has qualified under various tests.
Well, so how many of these visas, you know, for investments are there?
So last year, there were a little under 10,000 of these visas that were issued by the State Department. And the vast majority, I believe it's about 85% of those, go to applicants from China. Yeah. For example, in the Kushner project in Jersey City, about a quarter of that project's financing came through this program, about $50 million. And either substantially all of it or all of it came from investors in China. And the reason that real estate investors like the program so much is that the investors aren't particularly interested in getting a return on the money they put in, because the primary purpose is not a return. The primary purpose is to get a green card. So it's essentially morphed into a form of cheap financing for real estate developers.
But cheap financing for real estate developers and a clear path for, as you say, largely Chinese families to get a path to citizenship in the U.S. Look, Donald Trump has been hugely critical of China, saying the Chinese are taking away our jobs with production that's sent overseas. He's talked about imposing huge tariffs on China. Has he talked about this visa program?
No, as far as I know, he has not discussed the visa program. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about this is there's a couple of potential issues going on in a few different directions. One is that the Government Accountability Office has done a number of reports raising questions about what they call the insufficient background screening on where some of this money is coming from. In one case, they found that a prospective applicant was getting money from a series of brothels in China. So there are concerns both about the sources of the money and whether this is essentially a program that could be used to enable illicit financing to come into the country. And then the other issue is a lot of the applicants are getting ripped off. You know, there has been litigation involving applicants who put in money and then it disappeared. So overall, it is a program that is, if you believe the GAO, is in serious need of additional oversight.
Well, there's a third concern, which is that the applicants aren't highly vetted. There was a memo last winter from the Department of Homeland Security saying EB-5's visa holders don't go through the same, you know, jump the same hurdles as other immigrants applying.
Right. There is that. And then, of course, one of the issues that's of, I think, of tremendous interest right now, particularly with Jared Kushner, is both the problems with the vetting and also the identities of the investors remains anonymous. So, for instance, Jared Kushner has raised $50 million through the program for his building in Jersey City. We don't know who his investors are through the program.
And he's about, as we said, he's about to become a member of the Trump administration, and there might be possible conflicts of interest there. But so it just sounds like in the negative column, there's an awful lot. There's this thought that this money might be laundered. There's the thought that people might end run security measures to get into the country. There's the concern that the applicants might lose money, that it might be a shady deal on this end of the equation in the U.S., and that it's not transparent. We don't know who they are. Why, given there's such a hue and cry now about security and whether or not refugees can come in, why is this program still in place?
I'm not sure that I have a great answer for that, except that it obviously has a significant constituency behind it, which are the developers that rely on the financing to do some of these projects. I mean, something else that I would say that, you know, I'm not sure if we've gotten a tremendous detail about, but, you know, the whole purpose of the program was to help spur investment in distressed parts of the country, in poor neighborhoods and in poor cities. And it has clearly morphed into something that is not that at all, right? I mean, it has helped to construct, the Beverly Hills Waldorf Astoria, you know, a luxury apartment project on the west side of Manhattan called the Hudson Yards, a casino in Las Vegas. These are not projects that I think that the writers of the legislation that created this program envisioned.
That's Jesse Drucker of the New York Times. We'll link you to his reporting at hereandnow.org. On the so-called millionaire visa. Jesse, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, over the past 20 years, charter schools have expanded across the U.S., and now the model is going global. In Pakistan, several education nonprofits have started to adopt government schools, bringing in new books, hiring new teachers, and revamping buildings. Laura Eisensee from Here and Now contributor Houston Public Media traveled to Pakistan with the International Center for Journalists and has the first of two reports.
3 years ago, Bushra Naseem left her tuition-free public school in Karachi and switched to a private school. She explains through an interpreter that she didn't like how her public school teachers treated her.
There was physical and verbal abuse, and now it doesn't happen here anymore.
That's because her new school is under new management. A Pakistani nonprofit called the Citizens Foundation took it over from the government last year. Now dozens of students are coming back. Students like Bushra. The eighth grader tells me she wants to become a fighter pilot when she grows up.
She was excited coming back because of the new course books, because of, you know, polite teachers. And she was looking forward to coming back to this school.
In the auditorium, middle and high school boys line up in rows, straight and neat, just like the military. They listen to an opening prayer. All this is part of a larger experiment in Pakistan to reform education. Several nonprofits, including the Citizens Foundation, Developments in Literacy, and CARE, have adopted hundreds of public schools. They take over management and often replace or retrain teachers. Some have long waiting lists or lotteries to win a seat in their classrooms. If this sounds like charter schools in the United States, where independent management groups operate public schools, it's because it's pretty similar. One difference is that U.S. charters are free. The Pakistani groups can charge a nominal tuition, a couple of dollars or less per month.
They have the more experience.
That's Fazlullah Pechuo. He's the education secretary in the Sindh province, and he's eager to partner with nonprofits because he believes they're efficient.
And a lot of agreements are being executed with EMOs, education management organizations, who are the private partners.
There is no solution to Pakistan's education crisis without dramatic improvements to the state of government schools.
Musharraf Zaidi leads the advocacy group Alif Alan. Just like in the U.S. and Pakistan, you'll hear similar complaints about charter schools, that they take much-needed resources away from public schools. Many public schools here are understaffed and underfunded. Teachers may not show up. Buildings are often in disrepair.
It's just that a coherent, successful, modern society, the backbone of that society has to be the government school, the free education that is going to be the difference between being average and being phenomenal.
That's why there's another strategy at play at the Fatima Jinnah Government School in Karachi. Here, seventh grade girls compete in dodgeball in the courtyard. The Zindagi Trust adopted the girls-only school 9 years ago. It offers chess, soccer, a library, and art classes. The trust director, Shehzad Roy, calls it a success for other reasons.
The most important thing why we're turning around government schools is change the system.
Roy is a Pakistani pop singer turned activist. He says the campus acts as a model to change education laws. He chalks up half a dozen reforms. They include a ban on corporal punishment and allowing non-government textbooks in the classroom.
And as an institution, yes, the school is doing really well. But more important thing is, are we impacting the system or not?
He knows that in Pakistan, more than 20 million children don't attend school at all because their schools are falling apart or the students have to go to work. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Eisensee, reporting from Karachi, Pakistan.
It is still raining and snowing in California today. The state has been pummeled over the last week. So much snow has fallen in the mountains that ski resorts have had to close. Mount Rose Ski Tahoe in Nevada, for instance, has received about 25 feet of snow, according to the Weather Channel. The good news is the skiing conditions should now be excellent for weeks to come. So what has all the precipitation done for the drought in California? Well, the U.S. Drought Monitor said this morning that for the first time in a long time, just 65% of California is now in some state of drought. It was 82% just last week. And the worst level of drought, exceptional drought, now applies to just 2% of California around Los Angeles. 1 year ago, 42% of the state was in that highest level of drought. Now, there are some immediate dangers in California, including the threat of mudslides made worse by wildfires last year and heavy rains today. According to the National Weather Service, Los Angeles is now at 150% of rainfall for the season.
Well, in the wake of December's ghost ship warehouse fire in Oakland, California, that killed 36 people, cities have been trying to figure out what they can do to create more affordable housing for artists so they don't feel like they have to trade basic safety for cheap rent. One possible solution can be found just south of Oakland in Santa Cruz. Rachel Miro of Here and Now contributor KQED explains.
Korean-American visual artist Hee Jin Lee has lived in Santa Cruz for 14 years. It's fair to say she loves it here.
The air, the sun, the wind, the colors, and I feel so connected with all those and put me focus for my create.
But making art and teaching art don't bring in a lot of money. And Santa Cruz, a bedroom community for Silicon Valley, is an expensive place to live in, which is why the Tannery Arts Center is such a lifesaver for Lee. She pays about $1,200 a month for a three-bedroom live workspace, something that would cost her two or three times as much on the open market. Lee loves the price and the fact she's surrounded by people she can collaborate and party with.
Yeah, we made a big dance party in here, so everybody enjoyed the art and dancing.
The Tannery Arts Center is a $42 million art campus on 8 acres, including 100 live-work units and 28 commercial art studios, made possible by one of the nation's biggest developers of affordable housing for artists, ArtSpace. Based in Minneapolis, the nonprofit has helped develop 43 different projects around the country since it launched in 1979, from New York to Houston to Santa Cruz. Greg Hanberg of ArtSpace oversaw the development of Tannery.
ArtSpace kind of lives at the intersection of economic development needs, cultural facility needs, historic preservation needs. And when a community is grappling with those issues, they find us.
Following the Oakland warehouse disaster, a growing number of cities are looking to ArtSpace because of its experience helping cities pull together the local, state, and federal funding required to develop affordable housing for artists. Hanberg says every project is different, but the financing works in much the same way.
The most important tool in the Tannery financing picture was something called the Federal Low-Income Housing Tax Credit.
That means banking companies like U.S. Bancorp and Washington Mutual paid for much of the project in exchange for tax breaks. Grants covered the rest. And a city like Santa Cruz got a multi-million dollar complex for a fraction of the cost and a low debt load going forward. Not that these accommodations are luxurious. The floors are basic concrete and vinyl tiled. The bedrooms, bathrooms, and kitchens are bare bones.
They're very simple, hard surfaces on the floor, easy to maintain for the residents, but also gives them the flexibility to design their space however they want to use it.
Warren Reed works for the John Stewart Company, the firm managing the Tannery Arts Center in Santa Cruz. He shows me around.
Of course, here being a lot of the residents are visual artists. They hang their arts out in the hallways. And it changes. It's like an open-air gallery. It's kind of exciting to walk through the halls and see what's happening.
Now, why prioritize artists over other people who need help, like vets and seniors and disabled folks? I asked Bonnie Lipscomb, Director of Economic Development for Santa Cruz.
We've housed over 1,200 units of affordable housing in our community in the last 20 years. So we are concerned about everyone. What we saw here that was happening in Santa Cruz around 2006 or 2009 was that a very specific vital part of our community was leaving because they couldn't afford to live here anymore. And that's part of our whole cultural identity.
Tannery was the first art space project in California, but two more are in the works. That said, supply will probably never meet demand. It took nearly 15 years to develop the Tannery Arts Center. The units filled as soon as they opened in 2009. And now there are around 300 people on the waiting list. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Miro in Santa Cruz.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.